Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to Weird Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. That's me.
Brian Brushwood.
Hello, hello, hello.
We could talk about how awesome the penultimate episode of Game of Thrones was, but we're going to hold off on that right now and just dive right into some weird things.
Sounds good.
I'm all about it. Yes.
Speaking of, you know, the topic of ancient civilizations and really, really deep history is kind of a really cool concept from, you know, Tolkien mythologies and others. And, you know, for the longest time, you think about where people living in the medieval world, you know, you'd look and you'd see these ruins of Roman ruins and, you know, what was Londinium and these other places. And you're like, man, these ancients, they had it. You know, we're a civilization in decline. And that's kind of for most of human history. I think that you kind of lived in the shadow of what came before you. The great civilizations were the ones before you. You know, if you think about that, how often do you go to, you're in the Middle East, you go see the pyramids, like, we can't build that. You know, we can now, but for most of history, you couldn't. And a topic that came up in interesting, I always love that idea, like, what if something did happen before? What if there was even something beyond that, bigger than that? And I found a cool article. This was from The Atlantic, and it's Adam Frank was actually talking to a physicist, I think, in a talking about climate science. And they brought up the suggestion, because what they're doing is talking about looking at, like, what are the signatures from pollution in the atmosphere? How do you measure this? The question says, how do we know that we're the only – the question of how do we know we're the only time there's been a civilization on our own planet, okay, which was this question was posed to him, because he made some comment about, like, oh, this is the first time we've ever seen this. And the other guy's like, well, how do we know? How do we know? And neither one of them really believes that, you know, there was some massive, huge civilization before us. But it's not something you should just discount scientifically. You can't just throw out and say, well, of course there wasn't. And they went through kind of an explanation of what would be the signatures of another civilization. And they're talking, like, because if you go back, like, up to 2.5 million years ago, you know, everything kind of gets wiped away, you know, on the surface. You have to dig deep down, and very few things fossilize. We've talked about this. And, you know, what are the traces they look for?
So I suppose we're constructing a scenario where – imagine a MacGuffin that causes our world scientists to know for a fact that there was a civilization before. Maybe Elon Musk. You know, we land on the moon, or maybe on the dark side of the moon, going around. We catch a signature or something zaps, or maybe something's etched into the lunar surface that it's like the most reasonable. Estimate was that at some point there was a spacefaring society on Earth that put this for posterity, and either nuclear war or had chaos or whatever set everything back. What would we look for? Because it would have to be so far back.
They give an example of some of the signatures that we're leaving now. Because, like, there's the argument, like, well, we're in this thing called the Anthropocene, and there's pro and con to that. But you would see one of the big things would be elevated levels of nitrogen because of our use of fertilizers, right? You know, if you have a large global spanning civilization, you would see in sedimentary levels, like, wow, there are these nitrogen spikes that had to be happened from artificial fertilizers, probably plastics. There would probably be layers of some plastics and stuff if they use plastics. Other things they might see is they said even steroids, like there might be some steroid chemicals that you would find there that, you know, there are stuff. So they make an interesting point of, yeah, synthetic steroids or whatever, that they could be detectable up to like 10 million years later.
Wow. Yeah. I guess if there was a sentient civilization, doesn't necessarily have to be humans.
Right.
What era in geologic era would you want to peg that at?
You know, I want to avoid the bias of one of the things that we kind of say that, like, oh, we came about when we did, because finally brains evolved to the point to have neocortexes and stuff like this. And then that's sort of been the sort of thing, like, it was harder to have because brains weren't sophisticated enough. But then we get surprised because we discover some animal that has a radical, like, you know, take a squid or an octopus, has a radically different brain architecture, does really smart things. And sometimes we find out these things can develop really fast. So I don't know. I couldn't tell you because we've seen, like, you know, we had apes for millions of years and we've been using fire for longer. And then all of a sudden, boom, we're everywhere.
I got to be honest. If we were this is problematic from an energy perspective, but there could be a squid civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the nature of water and decay and the lack of bones, which means no fossils or very few fossils or fossils in a place that we monkey people wouldn't stumble across, it feels like it would be an undersea civilization. If I was going to place a bet for a full-on civilization that existed before ours, I think it has to be undersea, right?
It could be a multiple thing. And there was a story we talked about a while ago, was a researcher sort of threw out this sort of, hey, look what I found. And it was fossilized whale bones that appeared to be arranged into like a pattern. And he's like, maybe a squid did this. You know, maybe a really super smart squid did this. And people are like, nah, it's maybe natural, but it's like, you know, it's not the dumbest thing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can picture hunter-gatherer tribes of squids that have symbolic representation and tell stories, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, squawking at each other or whatever.
Like whales do?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
man, we got to get us a whale. Can we just buy a whale?
Someone look that up. Is that on Amazon Prime?
Well, that's actually another topic we'll get into. I think I may have this. I have it saved for another episode, but we can get into that too. but yeah, that is anything. Like, what would you look for? What would you look for in that? And it's not. And they talk about the hallmarks that we have of a global civilization, but if it was much more localized, and that's the argument I made. Like you could have had 100,000 years ago, Europe was warmer than it is now. You could have had, and you had apes, you had modern humans, proto-modern humans were on the planet, and you had other species that were like it. You know, you had Denisovians, Neanderthals that had already spread across. You may could have had this Roman-level civilization for a few thousand years, then the ice caps expand and flatten everything.
So,
you know.
There's a kind of a side jag. This, on a very personal level, you know, the property that we just bought that was formerly a cult compound, formerly a nudist colony and all that stuff.
And we'll be all those things again.
Indeed. We had somebody, an architect come out who specializes in what he calls living architecture, these kind of core principles. And he does a lot of stuff with Native American communities and all that stuff. He is convinced that this area has bones from tens of thousands of years beforehand, because it's the beginning of a spring. It's a fertile valley and all that stuff. In a very practical, tangible, concrete sense, I want to know, like what you're proposing, in other words, Andrew, is a very real problem for me to solve, because I don't know what evidence to look for. Like, I certainly on the property have evidence of civilization 40 years ago, because there's a bunch of cans from the 1970s with ring pulls and church key pop tops on there. But I've started to enjoy this sort of amateur trash archaeology to try to figure out, like, okay, of all the crazy people over the last few hundred years, why is everything the way it is right now? But the idea that that can go back to 10,000 years and the non-zero possibility that this was the home of a tribe due to, you know, a convenient geography. I don't know. Like, I'm very much, I would like to subscribe to your newsletter is what I'm trying to say.
Well, and we mentioned this on a prior show, is that I actually have an upcoming book. I have a person who has a piece of property not too far from where you are. And one of the observations is the fact that that part of Texas, that area, there's deep, deep human habitation history there. And it would not be the craziest thing. And, you know, one of the reasons that, like, and I mentioned before, when I pull out one of my Neanderthal things, like, man, it's amazing you could find that. It's like, well, it is and it isn't, because, you know, yeah, Neanderthals were making this in parts of Europe for over 500,000 years. You know, 500,000 years to accumulate, that's a lot of flints. That's a lot of things to accumulate. And if your area has been habitable for thousands of years, and – you know, we keep pushing back that edge of North America, like 24,000 years, some people arguing, or more. And I've got my pet could be 100,000. Like we might look in some place. I think we may find, you know, we told the story before, but do you know the story about they found a Neanderthal like arrow or hand axe or whatever in, it was like North Carolina or Mississippi?
No, I don't know anything about this.
They found this was Neanderthal, you know, Neanderthal style structure, Neanderthal whatever, and they found this like in the Mississippi, somewhere in the South, whatever, like this. Somebody was, you know, looking through the geologist, looking through the river, and they find this thing. And it's like, it's a big friggin' mystery because it's also, you know, in the riverbed, and it's finding that is really, even if you had Neanderthals here way back 50,000, 60,000 years ago, because they figured out a way to get over here, whatever, finding that just seems so unlikely. There was a very rational explanation for how it got there. And of course, we would all figure, no, you have to, you know, the person who found this thing did the research and found out that there had been an explosion of a steamboat there like 80 years before, back when we were using steamboats. And steamboats used to use ballast and rocks and stuff. Often you'd get your ballast at the port or whatever, because it came over from Europe. Ships had come over from Europe, loaded with rocks and stuff that were dug up over there, put into the boat to level it out. And then that ballast got put into a steamboat, and it was going up the river, and it had a boiler explosion.
Oh, man. So what they perceived as a rando rock happened to be an artifact. I guess this is similar to, remember in the late 90s, they were like, oh, they found microbes on Martian meteorites or whatever. And it's like, well, how does a Martian meteorite get to Earth? And it's like, well, you bang a rock hard enough on Mars, you know, mm-hmm. send a little bit of Mars up into space where it might land on Earth.
Yeah. And it's, you know, they're now, that's kind of a side note. Like, I think a year ago or last year, 2 years ago, there was we looked at the data and we found that there was an asteroid or a meteor that hit the atmosphere. And we don't know if maybe it landed and became a meteorite, but we looked at this. And we said that trajectory, extraterrestrial. I mean, outside of our solar system.
Oh, extra solar.
Solar. So we're like, wow, that's really kind of amazing that we know that we've been bombarded by objects that come from entirely different solar systems, which, you know, well, Superman got here too, but that's side note.
what's your pitch? If there is a precursor civilization on planet Earth,
do we need to have a way? I mean, should this be a thing that we start? Would archaeologists notice? Or would we know where to look? I guarantee you that once the idea is out there, we might look at things. We might say, like, you know, turns out 65 million years ago, some proto mammals built this iridium reactor that blew up, you know, and then we thought it was a meteor. Turns out, nope, nuclear.
Oh, that's interesting. So the pitch you're making is that, what was it? The, I want to say K2. That's not it. But the Yucatan Peninsula, iridium blast that wiped out the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe the problem, the storytelling.
I don't think that was. I just make that clear.
No, I agree. But I think that is a fun idea. I guess the only things I could think of is like if they were so advanced they could dig deeper than we're able to dig, but I don't really see that.
Well, it might be an interesting thing to say that, like, asking a question of what would be the signs and where, like, where you are, like you mentioned that location, like people like to live where people live. And there are probably geological things where we go back to a certain point and, you know, we don't find anything else because, like, yeah, well, before then it was covered by ice, you know, for 20,000 years. But it's like, maybe keep digging, you know, further on down. Or let's look at the, you know, using computers to figure out what topography was much further back might reveal a lot of stuff. You know, we've talked about places like Göbekli Tepe, which has 20,000-year-old stone, carved stone, work stones. It's not conspiracy theory, ancient alien stuff. This is a legitimate scientific, you know, exploration of this place where it predates everything else that we've seen. And we're like, yeah, in this area, yeah, they were carving, you know, 20-ton tones and stuff. And we didn't think that stuff was there until somebody bothered to date it. And like, oh, yeah, I guess there might be more of this. It's not like all of a sudden we're like, all right, let's carve rocks. You
know? All right, I got one. This is my final answer on if there was a civilization before ours, the way early days before the moon, before the moon was formed, like, would it be possible that all evidence would be wiped out. Like, the only problem is the timeline. That's really not enough time for a civilization to cook. But imagine that life developed, that it had a similar trajectory to what we just experienced. It was doing something, and then, you know, this massive thing that just liquefies everything creates the moon, and all of this before what we perceive as the beginning of life on Earth happened. Is that window possible?
I think Earth probably is still like all boily and stuff. You know, they're feeling lava at the time?
I know we assume so, but I could see, you know, a few numbers being off and maybe a society being there.
Well, you could go with some smaller scale stuff. Like, you could go back 100,000 years. And like I said, because once the ice caps come in and start flattening stuff, you would lose stuff. You know, it depends on what level of technology they reach. You could go back, you know, 100,000 years and keep going, and you could pick points for super advanced civilization. You know, you go back a couple million years, you know, that entire layer of ground has been just laid over and replaced. And, you know, we have to go to very stable regions in the world to find fossils. When we go look for fossils, is where things haven't changed much over time. It's just more dirt's falling on top. And that's, you know, we kind of forget, like, you know, a lot of places we're in, like, you go down hundreds of feet, that soil has been, it's new comparatively.
Yeah. I guess maybe this is one that we kick out to the folks at home is, what potential gaps in the record, because it seems like all the things we're talking about are places in what's known about history where the slate appears to have been wiped clean, and to ask, well, you know, what might have been in that gap.
You know, ice cores from Antarctica, because we can go back a couple million years in some places, that would be a good place to look for atmospheric stuff, which we do now. We can pick up, like, when we were testing nuclear bombs and stuff and things like that. Really, really, really deep ice cores could be an interesting place, because you could say, you know, what pollutants, what things got trapped. You know, there's certain, I don't know.
Cool, but yeah.
I'd love to hear the answers to that.
Well, I'll tell you what. You might have a problem with new soil, but you can help us hit pay dirt if you head over to patreon.com/weirdthings. That's
smooth.
Where you can support this show. That's where you can go ahead and get the After Things podcast before. Well, I mean, these couple episodes, I don't know if we're going to have After Things. But eventually, I swear, you'll reap the rewards. Just like, eventually, there'll be another civilization that will have completely forgotten this one. Folks, patreon.com/weirdthings.
Gentlemen, you know, we keep pushing back that whole, hey, at least we're safe on this. At least this is safe. And, you know, ironically, an organization that's designed to sort of help protect us from the onslaught of evil AI, which is OpenAI, keeps scaring the bejesus out of me. You know, they had, was it GT2 or whatever, which was their generation for text generation we talked about, which generated entire articles that were very...
Andrew, we all know exactly what you're talking about, but it occurs to me that maybe somebody in the audience might not. Bring us up to speed.
So what they did is, you know, OpenAI first, they worked on, I think we talked about a past episode, they developed a system that was able to take like millions of Reddit comments and then generate text where it could generate a complete articles. Like, it generated an article about scientists discovering unicorns in South America. Right. And was able to create these entire sort of, you know, narratives and stuff. They did Lord of the Rings fan fiction. And it wasn't amazing. And it wasn't like if you said a human wrote this, be like, well, they're a mediocre writer. But you find out a computer completely generated this stuff from just using one sentence. You give it a one sentence prompt and it makes up the rest. Kind of incredible. And I read through like several hundred examples of this, and it was incredible. And we talked about it in a prior episode. You can check it out. Well, they've applied this, and other researchers have done similar things. They said, what about music? What if we feed, you know, millions of songs and stuff to the algorithm, and we give it a first few bars of something? Will it compose a song? Well, yes. Yes,
really?
It can. So on that same page Bryce was just on, there's actually a thing mentioning the music. So they have an OpenAI project, which is called MuseNet, which basically generates 4-minute-long musical compositions with 10 different instruments, and from styles from Mozart to the Beatles to country music. And if we can see if Bryce can pull up some samples there. And it's basically what they did is they just fed this system, this neural network, a ton of different kinds of music.
Yeah, and dude, these titles are amazing. It says, so, prompt, Bon Jovi and the first six notes of Chopin OP27 number two.
Right. So I believe this is actually a synthesis from this MuseNet.
I'm not hearing the Bon Jovi.
It was given
in, Brian.
It was given the first six notes of a Chopin nocturne, and was asked to generate a piece in a pop style with piano, drums, bass, and guitar. The model manages to blend the two styles convincingly. So this is the intro.
Wait for it.
This is a little scary.
Yeah. Need some lyrics, guys. Come on.
I remember us talking about this well before GPT-2 came out, but the idea of machine learning music synthesis. And I remember being resoundingly told that that was very far away at the time.
By who?
By you!
But music?
Yes!
No, music's been done. Music's been done before. They've been doing generated music.
Didn't Stephen Wolfram do a music thing?
Yeah, no, Bryce, they've been doing music with this sort of stuff. Yeah. As far as doing full-on lyrics and somebody singing, that's further out. But no, this is the latest iteration of what we've been doing for trying to use AI to simulate music. In many ways, predates textual generation, because music is just a much more shorter sequence of notes.
These are just a bunch of examples. They don't have like a interactive thing that we could play with.
No, it sounds like the actual software will be released May 12th. So it might actually be out by the time you listen to this.
Wow.
Yeah. No, Bryce, you wanted me to tell you you were safe.
Here's another one. This one was prompted using the band Journey with piano, bass, guitar, and drums.
It comes out with Journey.
Yeah.
By the way, opportunity for anybody who wants to have a gimmick, have and a band, have all your music written by these AIs, have lyrics created word salad style with machine learning, get up on stage and perform it.
Press a button.
Yeah.
Okay, kind of Journey. I can kind of hear Journey in this, I guess.
So the point is, you know, we're not like going, oh my God, this is, you know, everybody run for the hills, throw, burn your musical instruments. But this is where we are now. And, you know, the problem you're at right now when you're trying to create this stuff is you take a bunch of music samples, thousands of music samples or more, tens of thousands, you know, and you put them into a computer, and it's got to go through and process all of those and try to discover patterns and do this sort of stuff in a naive sort of way. That computational power is intensive. It's really intensive. You find out that they took like maybe 100 GPUs and spent like, you know, 10 days doing this. As we know, with computing power, you know, today's supercluster is, you know,
it's tomorrow's iPhone.
Yeah, $100 Android phone. So
I don't know if you were maybe building up to this also kind of new thing that came out over the past like week or so.
Do you mind if I
play you a little bit of something?
Please.
Go for it.
Here.
Yeah, it's one of the side stages at Lala Coachella.
I think this is what the aliens in Contact, like, they heard from Earth.
This is a live stream called DataBots, which is, from their own description, a neural network generating technical death metal via live stream 24/7.
So all of this is procedurally generated. This is the equivalent of dialing in to watch a fractal get rendered.
Basically, it's even, you can even hear it try to synthesize like a singing.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, the vocals are the trippiest part.
And you can, if you really listen on headphones, you can definitely hear like the quality and like the fidelity of it is not quite there.
So,
but that stuff's only going to get better.
What's funny is now I have to think in terms of like when this gets posted on YouTube, are we going to get content ID'd for playing some of the procedurally generated noise from another channel?
No.
Yeah.
Though I do think they have actually put out records that has music created by the similar neural network. We train a neural network to listen to a Cavemaster album for 2 days to generate 10 hours of audio. From then, Cavemaster themselves curated and arranged the album, added samples, titled it, and made the cover.
I showed up late to this, but I believe Brant posted a link to the article. Can you tell me what Brant said about the thing? There's a gizmo that watches a brain, and you just think about talking, and it was able to kind of make the words for you?
Yeah, I saw the headline for that. I sort of scanned by because it sounded similar to something else, but there may be maybe some new iterations on that. And that's the thing, too, is that, you know, you see these things like, oh, yeah, we kind of did a thing like that before, kind of did a thing like before, but then all of a sudden, yeah, now the thing's really amazing, has changed, and, you know, is... You know, I had a Verbot when I was a kid that you'd put in speaker into the microphone and go left, left, you know, and then it would kind of go and go left. And now, you know, we have our voice assistants and things like that.
The headline was scientists create speech from brain signals. A prosthetic voice decodes what the brain intends to say, not actually says, and generates mostly understandable speech. No muscle movement needed. This sounds to me, look, you put two of those, you put a gizmo on one person who thinks about talking, put a gizmo on the other that takes the rendered speech and transducts it directly into the hammer, the anvil, and the stirrup. That sounds like telepathy.
Yeah, and if we've learned from anything in the last 10 years, that making it very easy for us to go from the thing we think to telling everybody else about it, it won't cause problems.
Ha!
Problems. I think telepathy has been kind of ruined. The idea of how wonderful would it be had been the last 10, 15 years. It's 10 years has really been ruined with Twitter and cell phones when you realize.
because no, we're not awfully close to what telepathy is.
I need a stopgap.
That's funny.
Moving my stupid. If anything, maybe we need a thing to make it harder to move our mouths. Be cool. Mm-hmm. Also in the world of the freaky sort of news and stuff is, you hear about some scientists were decided like, hey, we got a little, we think we've got this little chemical elixir sort of thing that we can use it to revitalize cells, like brain cells that may have been dead. And what they're able to do is they use this on some pig brains. And they found a way to restore biological function in dead pig brains, like parts of the brain at least. And it's a very, they have a formula, their formula is BrainX, a hemoglobin-based acellular non-coagulative echogenic and cryptoprotective perfusate that promotes recovery from anoxia, reduces right perfusion injury, prevents edema too, and metabolically supports the energy requirements of the brain. Totally not marketing speech. So apparently they're working on a chemical. They said that their goal is that, like, hey, listen, you know, we could use this to revitalize people who may be brain dead. You know, you're brain dead. They declare you dead. They give you a little injection. Next thing you know, you start to get neural activity.
What's funny is I realized, oh, wait, there are people where they have a medical condition and this is a way to rehabilitate them. My immediate thought was best CSI ever, where it's just like, just get them alive
Who
enough.
Who killed you?
Exactly. Yeah. Just get them alive enough to point in the courtroom.
Well, the idea is that it could apply to everybody because kind of basically you decide you're dead when you're, you know, you can restart a heart, which that, you know, learning that we could restart a heart was a big deal to realize like, no, you can start that thing. What? Like, no, not dead. Like, we just start the heart. Oh, but they're alive. That's magical. We've fought back the Grim Reaper. Like, well, then there's brain death, you know, and then like, well, brain death, it can't stop. Like, well, no, actually, we can maybe a little bit while longer after the heart stops, we can still bring back the brain. And now they're like, yeah, no, we think we can extend that window of which we can bring back the brain. And that's when is dead, which is a margin that keeps getting pushed. They bring up the ethical. There's what they say is the ethical problem. Like, well, if we keep bringing back these people, you know, we where are we going to get our organs from? I'm like, well, how about dead people? OK.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, I don't even know how much longer we're going to have organ harvesting as a problem full stop, because we're not going to harvest them from other people. We're going to grow them in a lab, right? We're going to grow them in pigs.
Sure, but it's when we get which thing, you know. So if you have the BrainX formulas on the market tomorrow now, and you show up, not, you know, we find out that, like, oh, we can reduce the number of people who die from what we thought was irreversible brain death by injecting the BrainX. It's like, well, great, we got half the organs now. But I'm like, yeah, and we have half the people saved.
and also, I would love to push that forward. I would love for the problem to not be people are dead, are brain dead, and instead we're running out of organs, right? Yeah. Like, I want that to be the frontier we are now pouring our time, effort, money, and research into.
Yeah, which alludes to sort of, I don't want to get into, because it was, maybe some people still haven't, you know, 3 weeks later watched, you know, Avengers Endgame, but there's a, you know, the at the end there's a Brian brought up the whole point of a, hey, here's the problem you have to deal with now, you know.
I misheard you when you were explaining this. I did not realize they were keeping these brains alive in jars.
Well, I mean, it's easier to keep it in a jar.
What else are you going to do? Put it in an ashtray of a...
Put it in your lunchbox, Bryce, you know? Just keep it in your locker.
Bryce, I'm with you. They don't listen to them. I also thought it would be in a body.
That gives me a lot of, like, skeevies about this now.
No, I mean, wait, guys. Back up. This is how you're doing it in the lab. I'm not saying that that's going to be the procedures, like, oh, hey, yeah, you're an accident. Sorry, we got to pull your brain out and put it into a jar. No, that's how you test the thing. Wait, you're putting this in a Petri dish? I got to go inside of a Petri dish to get this cure? Like, no. We just put the cells to test the thing.
But this is a brain.
I'm going to take one of them pig brains. I'm going to put it on a chain. It's going to be my big piece. I'm going to encrust it in diamonds. That's a live pig brain in there. You don't have that live pig brain swag, dog.
Got a Jersey Mike sandwich bag. I'm going to put mine inside.
One of the researchers...
Is that a greasy sub? Nope. Pig brain. Alive.
It does say... One of the researchers does say, this is, quote, this is not a living brain, but it is a cellularly active brain, which I guess is
living
different.
Living tissue. Which is different from a living brain.
Still.
It's... semantics land.
The prospect is horrifying, though. Imagine just being a brain with no body in a... That is very...
I want you to imagine every statement he said by John Cleese.
Is that a reference to a thing?
Point is, like, if you take it from a comedic point of view, it sounds like, you know, no, it's not dead, you know, it's this thing. It's like, oh, it's like this. You're like, oh, okay. It's like, it sounds almost like a comedic sketch.
Yeah, no, yeah. But I'm dialed in on Bryce's take here. It's like, I can imagine nothing more horrific. Imagine that you die and then enough of who you are is switches flip back on. You have no sensory input whatsoever. No sense of body, right. No input, no sound.
No output.
Just.
Would that be a coma?
No, because a coma, you're not conscious, right? We experience, you know, sleep, but imagine, and even when we sleep, we're experiencing neurons firing that are telling us the story of, dream craziness, right? But like the idea being like having nothing but your thoughts
is beyond locked in syndrome.
Can I just interrupt again to say, this is not, to our listeners, this is not what these people are doing.
Yeah, no,
I understand that.
Hey, Andrew, I don't know if you noticed, we do a show. It's called Weird Things, where we explore these topics and not shut each other down.
We took a story that a writer said, here's the ethical thing to think about. And then we're running with that. I just want to make that very clear. And I guess we're weird things. We're allowed to do this, but I'll make this. Not to say that people ever mistake and go, oh,
sure.
Particularly when it comes to, like, I don't know, this topic or whatever, that we get this misunderstanding the larger public about this or by science journalists. Sure.
Oh, I'm not saying there are death panels out there.
The third part that David Benioff wrote Gemini Man.
Yeah.
True fact.
I don't know. I'm just.
Get it together, sheeple.
I
know that this is not okay. The
my,
thing that
I,
happened.
All I want to say is, yes, okay. Let's endorse. I'm how many times have we had these things where we're frustrated because we see a science journalist or somebody like this paraphrase or make a mistake about something, like, well, no, this is the way it is. We're dealing with a topic that, like, there are so many people who are anti this. There are so many people anti trying to do resurrections or anti trying to do this technology. We're not. There are people anti this. And to me, it's a serious issue because it's like, how many times do we have to sort of fight this? Like, no, we have this opportunity to make things really cool and do this. Let's explore this. I'm just trying to say, like, just so you know, it's not what the BrainX people are doing.
100%. Let me just say this. I am fully on the side of resurrection and brain. I'm on the record as stating that I would like to live forever, and I will take any and every pathway to get there. I believe that the right side of history is always on life extension and life preservation. Like, that is, every time that we have pushed that line forward, it has only taken somebody living an extra couple years or being saved from what otherwise would have been death, somebody that you care about, that you're like, oh, well, now I'm cool about it. That being said, I am interested in the Brian and Bryce thought experiment, because I don't know whether or not it would be indistinguishable from just a coma or something else where it's just soupy nonsense thought. Like, I don't even know if time would be a thought of in the same way if I were just a brain in a jar. And understanding that's never the goal of what anybody would want to do with a technology like this, I don't have any clue. So it's like, for me right now, it's like, yeah, I would certainly not like to be in a coma. That does not sound like a pleasurable thing. I wouldn't like to be in mega coma where I'm just a brain in a jar.
Sure.
Well, like, and then the corollaries to that, look at sensory deprivation research. What happens when you deprive the brain of signals for extended periods of time? And it's not good.
Yeah,
sure.
I wonder if would you, because we have sensory deprivation tanks, and we know that you begin to hallucinate. Like, absent any sensory input, your brain is like, well, there's got to be something there, and so it takes noise and starts kind of enhancing the picture. Mm-hmm. Do you think you would begin to manufacture a reality?
The brain probably has some form of, at least, nerves, pain sensing nerves. They would have to.
Sure, no pain sensing nerves.
I'll tell you, we are going on a path that's going to have Joe Rogan chucking his brain in a jar tomorrow.
Well, the question is like, when you do, there's a limit to how far they like to do sensory deprivation, because you start to kind of go, you can go nutty, and that's the thing, is you might reach a point where your brain just starts to break down, your cognitive functions break down, and the observer may stop functioning.
Sure. Yeah, and this is from the NPR story, just to double down on what you were saying, Andrew. The scientists constantly monitor the pig brain's electrical activity, Latham says. If they had seen any evidence that signals associated with consciousness had emerged, they would have used anesthesia and cooling to shut that down immediately.
So that's because they're trying to develop a thing that would eventually be like an injectable or something. You're in the hospital, whatever, and like, they're dead. Like, guard this organs. No, wait! We got BrainX, you know, and you inject it in the brain, and then all of a sudden, like, hey, guys, what I miss? That's the goal. But to get there, like, they got to put a bunch of brains in jars, and the point that you guys are making, what would that be like? That's a real fear in the research phase, is you don't want to have this animal, and pigs are smart, suffering if it's possible. So, like, we'll try to revitalize the cells, and they say that, as soon as they see some higher conscious things functioning, they're like, all right, we're going to put you to sleep. Don't let it get there, because that is a big fear of we don't know.
But wouldn't that partially be the goal? Or I guess not in this early phase, you wouldn't want any subjects to go through that, but wouldn't the goal of restarting the brain be to also continue higher consciousness?
When it's connected to a spinal cord and a body and everything else.
Right.
And that's one of the things they talk about, is the possibility of doing brain transplants with this. Just to me, just sounds like, I mean, I can't even fix my freaking iPhone. So, I mean, just, I can't even comprehend, you know, doing that. But scary times, guys, but cool. I obviously have a very knee jerk reaction to this, because I get just, I mean, and I know we're all on the same page. It's like you click the next thing to, like, the ethical dilemma of this thing that will save millions of lives. And that's not us, but it's that, you know, You know, I love Ron Bailey's talk about this. Ron Bailey Reason, and actually is where I found it, was Ron Bailey's article about this. He mentions the ethical considerations of it and all that too. So I highly recommend Ron Bailey. His coverage on, you know, and everything is wonderful. But, you know, we sometimes, you know, shut down ideas and scientific thought too quickly because it's too alien and too hard for us to comprehend. There's arguments about, like, you know, what we did with, you know, stem cell research, you know, that we might have been living in an age of cures and other sorts of things like that, maybe. But there's some people said that, no, it just didn't turn out the way we wanted it to. But gene therapy stuff and, you know, there's the, I don't know what the right approach is, but we can look at these technologies and go, man, the implication's amazing. We want to be approach it not here, but elsewhere, rationally.
Yes. Hey man, I got picks. If you guys want to do picks,
let's do picks.
Yeah. Did you guys ever listen to the podcast Missing Richard Simmons? Jerry, you ever give that a try? Dude, basically used to work out at Richard Simmons Slimmons studio, and then one day Richard Simmons just up and stopped showing up, and so he basically says, "I'm going to do something crazy and do a podcast." As I try to track down, where's why won't Richard Simmons come out of his house? And did the whole thing, and very clearly, from the outside perspective, I don't have any insider knowledge on this, but it seemed like around episode 8, it was like, so anyway, Richard Simmons' lawyers called to assure us that he's fine and we should stop doing this podcast. Mm-hmm. Great podcast, team. That's the end of the season. That RSS feed went a little bit dormant.
They're retooling it into a new show now.
Which brings me to my pick. He's making it into an anthology series, and he did. I just finished all of Surviving Y2K. It's like four Y2K stories trying to put a perspective on the hysteria that struck a lot of people and why it is that we respond to those things. And you know, he injects himself into the story directly on that in a very it's a really interesting way.
Goes back in time to cause Y2K.
I guess I'll spoil somebody else's personal story that he's already told in public. He talks about getting married and then in the run-up to Y2K realizing that he's gay. And the experiences that he describes occasionally in graphic detail. It was a fascinating story. But the one I'm loving right now is Running from Cops, where it talks about the fact that we've had 19 seasons of Cops. And there's a lot that, depending on what lens you look at it, it's like, oh, it's journalism. It's a ride-along. It's they're telling a story. But then that changes when you realize that no, but the police have total editorial control about how it goes out. And then you start to hear the stories of, well, I would never take a minor drug bust and then put 4 minutes of question and answer about why somebody takes drugs. That's a thing as a cop I would never do. But the producers need to flesh out the segment. And then you start to blur those lines of like, these are keepers of the peace and people that we have to trust implicitly. What happens if they're also essentially game show hosts? And then like they watch 850 some odd episodes and they log what type of arrests show up there. And you would think if it's a remotely accurate representation of what it's like to be a cop, then you would see something close to the normal distribution of arrests, but instead, because drug arrests are very simple narratives that the cops who have editorial control like to tell those stories, as a result, you get a completely distorted view, and then you get the feedback loop effect of like the war on drugs caused cops, which caused a doubling down of the war on drugs. Some really fascinating thorny ethical considerations, and it's just fascinating. I'm really enjoying it. They're only like 3 or 4 episodes into Running from Cops right now, but you can listen to the whole thing if you do Stitcher Premium, which I'm thinking about maybe doing just so I can binge the whole thing.
That is a very interesting, like, that debate of like how much, obviously opening up law enforcement and having transparency is great, but as when it becomes a TV product, it's not as transparent as we feel. And I'm also like, I'm one of these people, like, when I've heard, like, oh, they decided not allow cameras into a courtroom or whatever, I'm like, I don't have a problem with that. You know, I mean, if we're doing transcripts or stuff like that, because I don't know, do they belong there or not? I mean, I think having, you know, maybe there should be an official record of what's there that you could go back and check. But to put TV cameras and stuff in courtrooms and stuff is, well, not every person who's accused of murder has to deal with that. And if you're dealing with that, then it's going to be, your case is going to be different than something else. So I don't know.
Yeah. And I wonder what we will look back on this live PD show in a few years in the same light, which is like, it's an actual live stream of cops out and about, and all of the same implications, except it's literally not edited.
Well, and we've already seen precursors of those discussions because you know, that terrible New Zealand attack, the dude live streamed it on Facebook, right. And which, yeah, oh, I mean, there's very creepy questions.
Yeah.
But anyway, headlongpodcast.com, you can see all that. All three of those, I highly recommend.
Yeah. Missing Richard Simmons is good, even if the ending is definitely like, oh, they found him.
Turns out he's just at home, taking her easy. Bye.
Well, any other picks?
I have a pick. This will be a few weeks old by the time you hear this, but it just came out today. Comedy Bang Bang, kind of one of my staple podcasts from a long time, just had their 10th anniversary the week that we're recording this. And so to celebrate it, they did this big 10-hour episode of all sorts of guests coming
Holy
in.
Holy cow,
and doing,
big names.
Yeah, and doing doing characters. It is so long that in the public feed, it's two separate 5-hour episodes.
Wow.
I am only like... not even an hour into it, but it's very good. They put all your favorites up top, and it so far promises to be a very good time. It's been I kind of fell off the Comedy Bang Bang bandwagon not very long ago, but this is
Comedy
this,
Bang Wagon.
But this is the sort of thing that I think if you had an interest in the show, is worth checking in on.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I, part of the reason why we are doing episodes early is because both Andrew and I are going to be out of the country at the same time. And part of the thing that I had to deal with was I used to have global entry, which was able to get me through customs coming back a lot faster. That lapsed, and I have not had the time to get reactivated basically on time. So I'm going to be trying something. This is a pre-pick. This might, a live episode down the road might, reveal this one to be a bummer. But I've heard very, very good things about Mobile Passport. Mobile Passport is an app that basically allows you, when you're coming into certain ports, to pre-file all the things that you normally declare up at a guy in customs. So if you're traveling out of the country, you basically you scan your passport. The passport gets scanned. You do all the questions that they would normally ask for you. And then you get a little QR code that has its own separate line when you're coming back into the country. Now, apparently, the free version of this app, which had been very popular, now many of the best features are in a paid version of the app that is, a couple bucks. But I will say this, if it works the way that it says it works and you are able to skip a massive customs line coming back into the country, it is worth chopping off a couple bucks to skip that line that can oftentimes stretch into the, hour range coming back. So I would recommend.
You know what this reminds me of? In a similar vein, the idea of virtualizing what traditionally is a face-to-face interaction. I had I forget what it was, but I needed to get something notarized, and I was able to use a online notary. Have you guys ever done this? All you need is a webcam, and basically you hold up your ID, you do this, and you sign in front of them, and you don't have to go find a notary. I thought that was pretty great.
Very cool. Yeah. Like, all right, now touch your nose.
Yeah, I mean, there is kind of that.
Hold up a newspaper with today's date.
Like, you could tell that essentially what they're doing is, it's being recorded, but they have to, in order to say, yes, you are the person who is signing the thing.
Right.
How long before we can't use that?
Yeah, we'll see.
You could deep fake, motion track a pass. It's like, oh, geez.
Yeah. Or if you had a good enough fake with a bad enough webcam.
Or a stand-in. I mean, I suppose that's no different than, I mean, if you're committing fraud, you're committing fraud. You could just as easily find somebody who looks pretty close to somebody and you steal their ID or make a copy of it. Or something.
But that's not the just as easily. You know, if it were a GitHub release from, hey, use this thing to fake a webcam thing where you can do it versus, I got to go find a Brian Brushwood. Well, we know a lot of Brian Brushwood people look like you. But I'm saying I think it's great now. But I'm saying is like, it's if you want to commit the fraud, sure, you can. It's how easy it becomes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like we realized email spoofing, like, oh, no, I can fake this coming from that email address. I can fake it coming from this phone number, which we're like, ah, it's fine. Email and phone numbers are great. No, they're not. My pick, Valley of the Boom. Nat Geo has done this process of creating shows that like are mixed between narrative and documentary. They did have the Mars thing where I thought, you know, the documentary I think was way stronger than the narrative stuff. Valley of the Boom is the story of basically the Netscape, the internet boom in the 1990s. And if you get past the sort of the way they're telling the story, which can be very annoying, it's over the top, but it's like you're watching scenes of them recreating stuff and people talking about what happened. And it's a neat overview of that period and that time. So worth checking out if you want to check it out. Valley of the Boom.
Cool.
Oh, there you go. And some, the story of Netscape, which was the biggest story until we forgot about it. And then there's stories of other people like the guy who, you know, like the complete scam artist who created one of these, you know, an internet startup and like while he was a convicted felon on the run and stuff and some other neat things. And then, you know, talking to Steve Case and stuff, the guys who did theglobe.com and whatnot. So anyhow. Wonderful. It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.